You already love the Mixing Music podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today. Back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host Liu Kong.
Yeah, hey, it's Liu Kang.
I think we did that one before. Liu Kang, Liu Kong. I assume from reference to Wukong, the Monkey King.
Actually, Mortal Kombat.
What? Hold on. What is the?
Yeah, isn't there Liu Kang?
Hold on. Mortal Kombat character.
It's spelled L-I-U-K-A-N-G. Liu Kang, Mortal Kombat.
Oh.
Yeah.
Never mind. That is a Mortal Kombat character.
Yeah, he's the classic. I don't know what he is, if he's like Korean, Japanese, or whatever, but just for the sake of it, just the dude with the red bandana.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I was thinking of an actual Chinese-made Chinese character, and you were thinking of an American-made Chinese character.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Let's get into this episode. This is a fun episode. We're going to get into the nuance and stuff. This is not about hot takes. This is about kind of addressing being real with people, real about stuff. People in the chat, in our Discord, have been doing like true or false statements. And I thought it was interesting because we could talk about, I even forgot about that one. That's a good one. So this started from Hanep Music on Discord. He asked, true or false, the client should never receive a mix you are not proud of. And that kind of started a conversation. I said, the job is not to be proud of the mix. The job is to provide a great mix according to the client's wants. Sometimes that means the mix is not aligned with the engineer's personal taste.
Yep.
So the answer is false technically, but hopefully the artist and engineer can collaborate in a way that allows the engineer to be proud of their work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, we just want to address the nuance of, and then I was like, hey, this would be a fun episode. Let's do more true or false statements. So we had like a few more. True or false statements, and we're going to answer those, right?
Yeah.
So the first one is like, the client should never receive a mix you are not proud of. Now, obviously, you should try to provide mix a song that you're proud of, like every single time. And there's going to be times like, especially like earlier in my career, I remember, especially when I was very prideful of my work, I would say things like, oh, I don't like it as much anymore. Like through the revisions, like it's not like, I don't want to put my name on it anymore. Those are like classic phrases that you hear noob engineers say. And you know what? I get that I don't think, again, what we're getting paid for is not to be proud of our work. It's to make the client happy. Again, that's what that means by a service industry, because we are a service, right? Providing a service. It's not a product. There is no objective end goal or some specific A equals B calculation. It is a service. So that's what that means. And so, it's not always to be proud of. That's not the goal. The goal is to make the client happy.
Yeah.
And usually when the client is happy, it's because we give them a mix that we're also proud of. Near 100% of the time, that's the case. But there's going to be times where, possibly through revisions or through the client's references or personal tastes, whatever the reason, you're just like not super happy with the way it sounds, but the client loves it. This happens as well as like oftentimes like looking back, it's like, oh, that wasn't my favorite mix, but I do remember the client loving it.
Yeah.
It's like, ideally you want to send in a mix that you're super proud of, but I think more than being proud of it, it's more important to send in a mix that you know the client will like.
Mm-hmm.
Because tastes are always different. Everybody's taste is different. Any yeah, nuance that no, you want to add to
honestly
that
one? Speaking, like that's something that's hard to come to terms with because a lot of people, they get into this for their own passion, right? We want to feel very proud of the things that we're working on. We want to be able to show it off. But that doesn't always come to light because we don't always work on the music that we personally listen to or really care to listen to. And that sounds weird to say out loud, right? It's like, wait, so you don't like the music you work on? It's like, that's not really what I'm saying. It's just that I grew up listening to rock. Never in my world did I think I was going to be making most of my money in hip hop and R&B. You know, it's just, it is what it is. You land where you land because your clients like working with you and they like the music that they like. And our job isn't necessarily to try to make it sound like the stuff we like. We try to do our own twist on the mix and stuff and add things that we like because they like our taste. But at the end of the day, it's not our song. So it doesn't matter. Realistically, it doesn't matter if we like it. As long as our client is happy, then we've done our job. Now, the better we get at the craft and the more we actually enjoy the process of the craft, you know, we're eventually going to also like what we do on records that we otherwise maybe wouldn't be listening to anyways. We'll still be proud of the work that was put into it, but that doesn't always mean that you're going to love the mix. You can still right. be proud of the work and not love the mix.
I will say though, I would say among more experienced, better engineers, instead mm-hmm. of having this idea of what is good and then bringing mixes to that idea, I think the best engineers are flexible, where like good
oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Is always super moving and subjective, and mm-hmm. they take it to where the song can be. And like a good engineer is flexible in their tastes and get excited about where the song can go rather than being like, I know, I like determining this is it, this is the end game, this is the goal. And I'm like, you know, it's more like the flexibility of moving to where it needs to be relative to the client's needs, wants, and interpreting what the client wants through their communication. It's not about taking to a specific place, but a lack of specificity is what makes an engineer great.
Yeah.
It's like, what does the song need? Where can I go? Can I take it to places that I've never considered taking it before that are even outside the scope of my own personal taste? That makes yeah. a great engineer. Anyway, so let's go on to the next one here.
Let's do it.
True or false? You can't become great at music if you lack a natural aptitude for it. You
Bullshit.
Can only ever become decent.
Sorry, I didn't let you finish that one, but my answer stands. Bullshit.
So I you think, say, so you can't become great at music if you lack natural aptitude for it. And your answer is false.
Yeah.
My answer is true, actually.
I'll give you my reasoning and you can come back to it. I think that if you're trying to be a singer and you sound like a halting truck, then you're going to have a hard time. But music is not defined by your natural ability to do it yourself. Sometimes it's by pushing through and learning another way around it. You can do fucking talkbox and be great at it, and that's still music. You don't know how to play guitar at all? Give it 5 years of honest intent and practice. You can still learn how to play really well. Now, are you going to have the same creative mind as somebody who's just naturally more creative than the next person? Maybe not. But if that person doesn't practice and put honest attempt behind it, they're not going to amount to much. It's like the whole high school peak kind of thing. Like some people are naturally good singers and naturally good musicians. And they get the high from their friends knowing that when they're in high school. And then when they get out of high school, they think they can still run off of that instead of continuing to practice their scales and keeping their voice nice and fresh and warming it up. But then here comes somebody who wasn't that gifted in high school and feels the need to work that much harder through college as they get their education on it, learn music theory and try to like really break through in hopes of becoming great, all in the process of not realizing that you're doing it. You're doing exactly what it takes to be great, which is practice what it is you're looking to be great at. A lot of people are naturally great at many things, but they don't practice it. And then it's not that you lose it completely, but you're just not going to be as good as you used to be. But some people get better with time because they continue to practice. You want to be a great engineer? Practice mixing. go do some free shit. You want to be a great musician? Practice your scales. You want to be a great vocalist? Get a vocal coach. I know too many good vocalists that refuse to get a vocal coach and they stay average good, like where like you're good, but you're not that good. Like you're still sharp, you're still flat. And a lot of great artists are that too. But you could be so much more if you just put a little more time into it. And here's so-and-so who never actually got like a singing position in their church or anything, who now sings circles around you because they actually put the time in. So do you need to have a natural aptitude to it? I don't think so. I think what you need is dedication and a pair of balls.
Right. So yeah. I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm going to give some nuance. Mm-hmm. I think you have a good point. And I think that's like the commonly shared point, right? I think it's, I think if you ask anybody, almost everyone is going to say false. You don't need to have a natural aptitude. I'm going to say true, partially for, to be devil's advocate here and to totally, give a little totally. Nuance. So you're wrong, I'm going to say it's true. That statement is true. You cannot become great at music if you lack natural aptitude for it.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's true. I am going to remove the limitation of aptitude being restricted to specifically music, but to, for example, having the humility to recognize that you have to practice is an aptitude, right? Yes. Is a skill set.
Yes.
Having the self-discipline to be able to practice is a skill set. More importantly, having the desire to want to practice and to learn to be humble. I don't know if that's aptitude as much as like it is like a character, like something that you're born with, right? Mm-hmm. Or that through whatever, nature, nurture, right?
Yeah.
But like having a desire to do music in itself is not something that everybody's born with. And yeah. I think you have to want to do music in order to become great at music.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people that pursue music, but they don't actually care about music. They care about the fame, they care about the numbers, they care about making income from
it. They fizzle out real quick.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's always real quick. I think most of the time it's real quick, but sometimes it takes them decades for them to realize that they were never doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And some of them, they like actually have success doing it for the wrong reasons, and then they're stuck doing that forever. And that's more rare, of course, but that does
happen.
It's
rare, but it does happen. I've seen them.
Right, and success isn't necessarily dictated by great, right? So the question was to become great at music. Like there's been a lot of people that suck. Like Rebecca Black's Friday. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
That do really well. Yeah. So I say yes, it does take us like a natural aptitude for it. Although I think that aptitude doesn't mean that you're perfect pitch, doesn't mean that you're really good at piano or really good at singing or really good at the computer. And there's more like meta things. Like you have good impulse control. You have good self-awareness. You have good work ethic. You have great discipline. Those things. And those are things that anybody can learn or pick up that start from a basis of wanting to do music for music's sake. And I don't think that everybody wants to do music. I don't think that everybody that says they like music actually likes music the way that I'm talking about in this scenario, right? And I don't think... people actually like everybody that is pursuing music likes music enough that they're willing to go through the bullshit of it. I think that I think that the CEO of what is Suno AI says most people don't enjoy production. I think that is a technically correct answer. Like I don't believe most people enjoy music production. In fact, out of everyone, most people don't enjoy music as much as like we as musicians love music, right?
Yeah.
And so we can't fathom someone who doesn't. But most of people don't like music as much as we do.
I was just going to say a great example of this to make it short is when you meet an artist who says, look, I don't know about that frequency stuff. That's you. That dude, line is like perfect resonance with the idea of like not everybody likes the production part. Some people like the music writing part, but they don't like the production, like the technical side of things.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like the classic answer of like the average person is like, what kind of music do you like? Oh, like I like everything. Okay, so you don't really like anything. You can't name me one person that you like. You know,
I think again, sometimes people answer that to be unintentionally non-confrontational. It's like, oh, I like this kind of stuff. It's like, oh, I don't listen to any of that. It's like, okay, whatever. What do you like?
Right. Yeah. And like, I like everything too, but I'll be able to name stuff. So there's there's a difference. My point is not that you can't do it if you don't have a natural aptitude for it. What I'm saying is you do need a natural aptitude for it, whether that's nature, nurture, genetics, or from your surroundings and how you were raised and stuff. You do need a natural aptitude for it, but it's not limited to specific music skill sets.
Yeah.
I do think that if you're totally tone deaf, it is very, very, very difficult to become great. In fact, Anne Frank isn't famous for being a musician. And I think, not Anne Frank, sorry, hold on. Holy crap, not Anne Frank.
Well, she's also not.
But. Yeah, that she's not either. Who am I thinking of? Who's the blind, deaf, mute girl? Who's the blind, deaf, mute girl?
I know who you're talking about. I think everybody knows who you're talking about, but I can't think of it right now. Anne Frank. I'm sorry. That was funny.
Not Anne Frank. Good, Helen actually. Keller. My bad. Helen Keller. Keller's not famous for being a musician. Listen, if you're born as Helen Keller, you might not be able to be great at music.
Once again, your statement was not wrong.
Yeah, also, Anne Frank, you get killed prematurely by an authoritarian government. That is so dark. That's so fucked up.
Jesus Christ,
my
man.
Bad. My bad. My bad. Not Anne Frank. Helen Keller. Listen, but that being said, Beethoven was going deaf and... but he also had a lifetime of music masterpieces. Yeah, dude, hear me out. Dude, I love my son to death. Second son, the one with Down syndrome. Dude, he loves music. He loves it. Anybody that says that my son can be great, we're not talking like good or decent, we can be great at music with his condition, like, little questionable. On that opinion there, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I love the, very idealistically, great. I'm going to raise my son to believe that he can do anything. And I do believe that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not going to set an expectation.
Yeah.
You know? And if he ever does become great, it would blow everyone's mind and he would become famous for breaking a barrier no one's ever broken before with Down syndrome. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, there was kids that were very good at artistry as far as drawn works, painted works and things like that. So maybe. But you're like, I know my kid well enough to where I know this kid is not doing that specifically.
Dude, I don't know. I need to look it up. But I mean, the point is,
oh, dude,
the point
powerlifting is, and all that is crazy big.
No, I'm talking about music specifically.
No, I get it.
Every single Down syndrome person I've ever met is totally tone deaf. And it's kind of funny, Ann.
I can confirm through my uncle. I can absolutely, yeah, when we sing along together, not only is he off time, but he's way off scale.
But also, what does it mean to be, I guess the only exception to that is if that was the thing. Remember, who was that Asian dude that was so bad on American Idol that he ended up making his own album?
She Bang.
Oh, she
yeah. Dude, it's crazy. Hold on. I have to stop you on that one. You could be so bad and still get a 3-album record deal.
Yeah, that's true. But that doesn't, okay. Anyway, we're going to go on. We're going to move on to it. I'm going to say true on that one and I'm going to stick to it.
I'm going to stand at false and I'm just going to tell people to grow a pair.
Here's the thing too. I'm going to end with this caveat. I don't think that it's, do not consider how good you are at music to be a vertical hierarchy. And I don't think anybody should. I don't think anybody is better as a human being for being good at music. Yeah. I don't think anybody is better as a human being or more important
than
another person.
It's just a creative art.
Yeah, it's not like if you are totally ass at music, that has no, it almost has negative impact. I probably would respect you more if you were doing music and you were just shitty at it. That's more respectable to me than someone that does something that they're really, really good at. It doesn't mean anything. Let's say yes, it's true that you can't do good without a natural aptitude. That doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that you're better off or worse off than anybody else. It might change your career trajectory, but it's as a human being, it doesn't matter. All right. So don't judge other people's in a vertical hierarchy based on their music skill. That's just a dumb reference point to begin with. Okay, that was from, by the way, that was from Raichu. Another one from Hanep Music. True or false? If it sounds good in mono, it sounds good everywhere.
No. I think if it sounds good in mono, that's great. But not everything is in mono. So like if it sounds good in mono when you sum everything together, that's great for phasing and things of that nature. But just because it sounds good in mono doesn't mean slamming all your drums completely to the left and the only thing on the right channel of vocal is great. I think you still have to balance things in the stereo field. But when you check it in mono and it still sounds good, that's great. But just because it sounds good, like if we're listening to it in a very literal sense, right? Just because it sounds good in mono doesn't mean it sounds good in whatever else you did. No matter what else, panning, EQ, or anything you did to the rest of the mix. As long as it sounds good in mono, it sounds good anywhere. I don't think that's a one-to-one yes all the time thing. For instance, like if you listen to older records, my favorite old record to reference is Sunny. Sunny, my left. All the drums are on the left. And then you hear like maybe some horns and vocals on the right. And it's pretty much just divided up. This is like in the hard left, hard right days. It's either in the middle. No, I don't even think there was middle yet because I don't think anything's in the middle on that record. But if you put it in mono, it sounds great. But in stereo, that shit's fucking nauseating. So right. is it a true or false statement? Once again, the answer being either true or false, not what's the nuance. It's false. Because that means I could do that again. I could just do another Sunny mix and pan all the drums to the left and all the vocals and horns to the right and just be like, hey, look, it sounds good in mono.
Right.
Yeah. So on that sense, no. But I'll tell you this as a guy that does live, which a lot of it is in mono. If it sounds good in mono, it sounds good in general. If you're doing live shows, yeah. Like I went to see Kanye this weekend. Pretty cool show. But because it was in a dome shape, the way the stage was set up, we're talking speakers flying in 360 degrees, which means there is no left or right. So panning left or right in that mix is not the goal. I'm going to be honest. I wasn't the biggest fan of the mix at that show either. So maybe this example is not great, but I could hear his vocals clearly. I could hear the music. It was a little bit harsh and stuff like that, but you have to think about the medium in which it's being played too. Like, are you talking about playing it in mono? It sounds great. So like if you put it on a radio station that's still broadcasting in mono, you're set, then great. But, you know, it's a hard and fast rule. I just can't agree with it. Like there's scenarios where mono is the only option you have, and that's great. But when we're talking about modern streaming standards where stereo and even Atmos is a thing, an Atmos mix, if it sounds good in mono, could fall apart the moment you go back to an Atmos balance, like where everything's panned around and surrounding. I don't know. I just can't agree with the notion that if as long as it sounds good in mono, it sounds good everywhere.
Right. There are some good things about mixing in mono, specifically about like masking frequencies.
Totally.
But that alone doesn't mean it's good. Yeah, because you can have bad stereo imaging and that would be distracting. And
you could also just have decorrelation by hard panning. So if you have two guitars and they're masking each other in mono, hard panning left and hard panning right decorrelates them. So boom, no more masking. You know?
Yeah,
so.
And then there are times where it's like part of that like density. Mm-hmm. If you like hard pan things left, hard left and right, and it's where it's a lot more space in between, like mm-hmm. you kind of lose that,
the weight.
I don't know. It's a little bit different sometimes. But yeah, that's false completely. There's very little nuance on that one. This next one's also going to have very little nuance too.
Lou is handsome. Absolutely true.
Lou is handsome. Absolutely true. Yeah. Here we go. True or false? Subs should always be in mono.
Ooh. Yeah, no.
My answer is false. Completely false.
Once again,
we talked about this.
Yeah.
We've talked about this many times in the past. The reason why sub-frequencies have always been mixed and mastered to be mono was because of the vinyl creation process, mm-hmm. where if sub-frequencies were stereo at all, the lathe doing the cutting into the press, into the metal mother, would pop out. Like it wouldn't be able to handle it. So they would mono out the sub in order to make sure that the needle would stay in. It would cut.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but think about promotion when you, we're not doing this as much today, but if you wanted to make a record break, you had to play it in the clubs almost. You had to play it on radio, which is majority mono, and you had to play it in the clubs, which is majority mono. So if you had a stereo sub and you didn't actually like double check that it's not phasing out in mono, you could have a song that had like some phasing issues in the low end. Mono was just a lot easier to just be like, listen, man, the low end is there. And if you flip it into mono, it's still there, you know?
There's so many ways of having mono compatible stereo subs too.
Yeah.
So totally. It's like at this day and age, it's like, is mono bass or subs important? Abso-freaking-lutely no. In fact, I would say that I would even argue that in most songs, having a slightly wide bass, it sounds better than having a mono bass up the middle. So, I really believe that. But that being said, again, you can achieve that without having an out-of-phase sub. Like, you can achieve some slight width or some slight panning in the low end, even additive, like adding some more width with current plugins and stuff. And it does not at all affect the mono fold-down compatibility.
So something I've done is use Saturn on a separated track and just distort the living hell out of the bass in a way that's more like airy fuzzy. Like, so just taking out all of the low end out of it and everything and just using the harmonics that it built and then putting those to the sides.
Right.
So keeping the hard hitting bass in the middle, it's still in phase and everything, but then all the harmonics that it's getting out of like Saturn, throwing those to the side, it makes it feel wider if you want to keep it in mono, but you could kind of hear it when you're listening to a mix and you're just kind of vibing out with it. You're not paying attention to the mix, but when a bass is nice, big and wide, how it kind of makes you feel like you're in the mix versus something just hitting.
All right.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so
if you are doing production for live, once again, like if you're making records to perform live and everything, when it comes to playback, a lot of times they'll mono out the sub, even if it wasn't stereo, because most live setups have mono subs.
Also, if you're doing like 5.1 or Atmos, there's mono LFE sub. Channel, a dedicated LFE channel. And that's more of this, just like the technology and what it's doing, like utility of it rather than like an artistic decision. Yeah. I also will go back on what I said. I said that most songs sound better without mono subs, like with stereo wide subs. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case, actually. I was over-exaggerating to prove a point, I'm now realizing. There are a lot of songs that sound incredibly awesome with a slightly stereo bass or sub or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't go as far as say most.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. Next one. True or false, Mixing Music Podcast is the best podcast ever. I mean, come on, that's just false.
Yeah. Listen, man.
Or should I say for the bit, yes, it's absolutely true. Have you ever listened to me and Lou go on
tangents? Have you ever listened to my voice and thought, I can't wait to see what he looks like? Well, you can now. Go to our YouTube channel and come take a look at this ugly mug.
Yeah, dude. Would it be better for to clickbait people? Dude, he is super ugly. Just go.
Just start telling people, it's like, bro, he's dressed as a frog today. If you want to see that, like, just go to YouTube.
Oh, man. This one's a little bit more interesting nuance, and I don't know, I think I might be able to give a little bit more insight here.
Mm-hmm.
True or false, you have to move to LA or somewhere that stuff is happening to be successful, which he defines, it says in parentheses, making a comfortable living is to be successful in music. So being successful means make a comfortable living.
I want to hear yours as somebody who had to, I'm LA native, so I don't count in personal views, but I do want to touch on people I know. we don't have to name names or anything, but I want to hear your point of view, because we know that you actively went through it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I will say that that this is obviously false. There's people all around the world, all around the U.S., all around different countries, every single country, right, where mm-hmm. people are making a comfortable living from music. Do I think that it's easier to climb the ladder of the music industry in L.A., especially as an engineer producer? Absolutely. Now, if I'm an artist, that matters a lot less, because I just have to go viral on TikTok or YouTube or whatever, right? And anywhere, like, artists pop out from anywhere. They can make music from anywhere. But as far as like a regular job, like music management, music production, engineering, corporate music stuff, yeah, most of these labels and people that they're hiring for, people that that are hiring for these positions, are in the big music industry cities. That's just how it is. They do exist in smaller capacities remotely, but almost never for the other positions that I mentioned. Like, if you're trying to do sync music, maybe you can make sync remotely here and there, but like, there's just going to be more opportunity being in town. It depends on the scenario too, because like, I also have composer friends like in Utah that are doing really well in Utah, but there's just, the ceiling is so much higher in the music cities that so the answer is false. You don't have to be in LA to make a comfortable living. I am going to add the caveat though, that in most career pursuits, it would like raise your chances, and you would have more networking opportunities, more opportunities in general to be in LA.
Yeah,
I don't think that means that all the jobs are here and you can't make it elsewhere. I think that it's actually harder to do it anywhere else.
Yeah. With that said, it is kudos to those who have made it happen anywhere else. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I honestly think like anybody that can make it happen anywhere else can definitely make it happen in LA to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Right. It's, the game is a little bit different, but I think it's different. Like, if you're able to make 100K, like six figures, outside of LA as a mix engineer, it's like, first off, you probably don't have to live here. You're probably really, really on top of your shit.
Probably, like, you really don't have to live here at all, considering if you're making six figures in another state, chances are your entire cost of operating is lower too.
Yeah, dude, you're probably, also, I'm just guessing, like, you're probably like the most on top of your shit that I've ever met. Like, you're probably
the coolest,
like,
person in your neighborhood.
Yeah, you're probably on a deep schedule. Like, you have systems out the wazoo. You're probably contacting people every day. Like, you're probably doing everything else that you could possibly do, making content, taking people out to lunch, getting on Zooms, doing stuff for free. Like, you are probably on top of your shit more than anybody else ever.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. Okay, what did you want to say, Lou? What did you want to add?
I wanted to point out that there's plenty of people that we forget are not in LA, even as people in LA. For instance, you know, I don't forget that Gerhard is not even in the States. Man just became an official citizen of Canada. But Gerhard is killing it, you know? Him and Jesse have been tag teaming a lot of work together for a long time, but, you know, he's managed to not have to live in LA for too long of a period, or if at all. But like, shout out to Austin Seltzer, who's in Oklahoma. I thought this dude was in LA the whole time, the way he's moving. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those where I know he's friends with a lot of people that we know in LA. And I saw he posted that he's getting the Gerhard custom designed speakers built for him and all that kind of stuff. All the parts are being shipped to him so he can assemble and all that kind of stuff. I was like, dude, I got to come over and listen to them. He's like, dude, I'm in Oklahoma. And I'm like, when the fuck were you in Oklahoma? Like, some people are moving so efficiently, no matter where they are, that you forget that they're not in a major city.
Right.
Yeah. Like anytime I'm out somewhere and I know somebody, I try to meet up with them. Like I'll be in Texas this weekend. So I'll be hitting up my Texas friends, seeing if they're going to be by the festival, if they want to come through, just to see faces and all that. But I always end up landing in like major cities. So you end up running into somebody you do know. But then there are plenty of places I've never stepped foot in that have people who are successful, who have managed to make it happen where they are. And that's amazing. Just keep doing what you're doing. If you feel like you have to move to LA, like DK said, there is reason to come to LA. There's a big reason, especially as an engineer. If you're a producer just getting started and everything, you know, you could come and intern for people right away, but you're not going to make money right away. So I would work on your craft, network with the people in your neighborhood, build a reputation as the big man in your neighborhood, then come to LA and do what you got to do, do what you want to do. If you want to go back to your hometown, just know you're going back as big man in your neighborhood again, you know, but yeah, become the big man in your neighborhood before, you know, making the big jump if you can, just so that when you come to LA, it's more of a situation of, what is it? When I'm going to butcher this, I apologize. But when opportunity meets, what is it? Practice? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, luck is like opportunity meets.
Opportunity meets. Yeah, I forget what the exact line is. I'm butchering it. But that's what it comes down to. Like
preparation. Opportunity.
I think that's what it needs to be for a lot of people. I don't think you need to come to LA right away and then just buy Pro Tools right then and there. I think you should work in whatever DAW you have, work with whatever artists are in your neighborhood and be the best person in your neighborhood. Outgrow that neighborhood. You know, really show that you can actually make it happen in your neighborhood. And then come to LA and fucking show that entire neighborhood what you're about.
I agree with that completely. Yeah. I honestly think that's part of the reason why I did all right out here.
Yeah.
Is
you didn't just walk in blind and dumb. You just walked in prepared and ready for opportunity.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like being here isn't going to necessarily start success, but if like you got to have some success locally.
Yeah.
If you can have some success locally, then you probably have the skill set to make some success here too. Right. I think that's a really good point. All right. Next, success is measured by streams, true or false?
False.
Yeah,
hold on. We're saying false for a very specific question, which is success is measured in streams. DK, yeah, were you successful before any major streams?
That's the thing too. That's like too subjective. Like the definition of success is so subjective.
Because
if you have like super duper deep goals and an identity bound by the number of streams, then sure. Yeah. But then the question is that a healthy thing or a good thing? And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but
like I'll put it this
way, measure success that way. I don't know a lot of other people that do. I mean, labels do. 100%.
Labels do. Yeah, yeah.
Like
totally.
if you are an A&R at labels and you sign an artist and they are not getting the number of streams, that is considered failure for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So success is measured by streams to an A&R, to a record label. But on a personal level, like as the engineer, not
best
necessarily.
Best question to ask is, do you have a roof over your head? Can you put food on the table? Can you actually enjoy yourself? Can you put money in your savings? Can you put money towards retirement? Can you actually go out and have a good night? If you can say yes to all of those, you are successful.
I will say that not always, but like oftentimes they are kind of hand in hand. Like someone that does have a stable career does have some streaming numbers to back them up, right?
Yeah.
But like not always the case. So I don't think it's like just because they're not doing well streaming wise doesn't mean that they're not doing well financially.
Now, also to add to that, just because they have a lot of gear doesn't mean that they're doing a good successful career.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like that's actually more of the case than the opposite. Like, Anyway. So that's just a weird, tough question to answer, but I think we don't need to say much more on that.
Yeah.
Now this one is one that we could talk about. I could talk about, I'm very passionate about this one. So Is it possible to make a living as an artist through streams? True or false?
So, yeah, I mean, the question is it possible? The answer is yes. Is it a measure of anything? No. But is it possible to live off of streaming? What do you need to live? Where do you live? What is your level of responsibility that you have to take care of based off of streaming? When we talk about like, hey, is $3,000 a month enough to live? You know,
right.
Like what's the basis, you know, but is it possible? Yeah, of course it's possible. I know plenty of people who make at least $5,000 a month off of Spotify, but they've also been doing it for so long and built a name, even if it's not the biggest name. Like I know plenty of people who are doing really, really well that also don't have the world's biggest fan base, but they have a dedicated fan base that just listen to the records all the time, that actually go out to the shows and see them. But if we're talking strictly streaming, yeah, it's possible. It's totally possible. But it takes a lot of work to get to that point. And I'm not going to minimize that, but it is right. Absolutely possible. If you live like a monk, especially possible.
Okay, so I have a very, very strong opinion on this, super strong opinion on this. Mm-hmm. I think that when it comes to this, people getting triggered by this, people getting upset by Spotify, talking about the greed of the industry, 100% understand where they're coming from.
Absolutely.
100%.
Yeah.
Is that true? Not even remotely close.
Yeah.
Like, sorry. Is the hatred against Spotify and saying that you can't make enough money in music through streaming, is that true? Not even close. It means that it is absolutely accessible and possible to make a full-time living through just streaming. Not yeah. even selling merch, not even going live. 100% possible. Yes. I genuinely think that anybody that complains about not making enough money from music is like actually not thinking. Like they are writing a narrative that they haven't actually Googled the numbers on, have ever thought about the numbers, have ever asked anybody, and they're like entitled that they think that they should be making more from the little success that they've had. Like most of the people that are complaining about not making enough money from streaming, most of them have like a couple thousand monthly listeners. Like,
yeah.
The fact that you think you should be making a realistic living from like that, like it's stupid. How come we don't hear nearly the same amount of complaints with YouTube?
Yep.
Right?
If you like, wanted to be a streamer, you don't start a tiny channel and be like, YouTube doesn't pay me enough.
I think it's like this cultural understanding that it's like it's difficult to make like we understand like it's more palpable and like to see what a good YouTube channel does and what a good YouTube channel like it's very easier to tell which YouTube channels are like high quality and yeah. enjoyable. Well, like for music it's a little bit more subjective, so it's like it's not completely easy to be able to tell. And most people have like so much egoic inflation with music that they could American Idol was like had a whole industry around this we talked about earlier, like where it was just like people with that are so blind to their own inability to do music that we as outsiders were laughing at them, and that was part of the entertainment. Yeah. Right. I for some reason culturally like that happens a lot less on YouTube. It's like, if you're not doing well on YouTube, it's like, yeah, we all know that you can do really, really well on YouTube. And so it's like people work hard and like you're either good or you're not. And there's like less complaining yeah. that YouTube pays enough. But there's a ton of that with like Spotify. But to me, there is no difference. There is very little difference. I mean, the money that you make is obviously different, right? The sponsorship, you can't do sponsorships on a song necessarily. Product placements on a song. But I mean—
Would you count YouTube towards your streaming income? Now, I'm not saying create a YouTube channel and talk on it. I'm talking about putting your music up, whether that be live performance versions and all that kind of stuff, doing a collaboration with so-and-so and making a video with that and putting it up on YouTube. Would that count? You're streaming it on YouTube, right?
Right. YouTube also does pay less for music channels, like in general.
No, so I get that. Like, what I'm saying is like, if you were to create alternative versions for people to listen to specifically on YouTube and build a YouTube following as well, I'm just saying there's multiple streaming platforms and methods you can go about it. It doesn't just have to be focused on Spotify.
All right. So let's look at some real world examples here. All right. This is on Reddit. My band has 125 monthly listeners, 125,000 monthly listeners, and we make about $2,000 a month from about 600,000 streams. So you got 125,000 listeners. It looks like on average about, you know, out of those 125,000, they maybe listen to it five or six times during a month. And that generates $2,000 a month, right? That's just Spotify. And that's, I don't even know if that's, I need to look. But you also can make money from outside of your distro services. Like you can make it from, if you actually put in your, use BMI ASCAP and stuff, they pay out separately as well. Mm-hmm. Another comment on Reddit, streaming is not as bad as people make it out to be. To be honest, I have a band over a decade ago that still gets 10,000 monthlies on a very small catalog. And I still see about $500 a year for my 20% split. Like, it's not something that you can pay rent with, but 10,000 monthly listeners from a band 10 years ago, and he gets $500 a year for 20%. Biggest complainers tend to be super small artists who don't get any streams, and then being super big, and then super big artists who only see a tiny cut and think that that's representative of their entire cut.
Yeah.
Let me go back to the specific numbers here. Spotify royalty calculator. Enter. So if we get, what is this? 100,000. Let's do 1 million streams. If you get 1 million streams, hold on. Yeah, so it's totally possible. If you, not just from Spotify, but make sure you do it through like BMI and ASCAP or whatever your, what is that called?
Your PROs, your performance rights organization.
Yeah. Make sure you actually collect, because I didn't know you can collect more through your PRO as well. I thought it was just when I was using DistroKid, I thought DistroKid was giving me, I thought DistroKid was giving me 100% of the money that I earned from streaming. And then the PRO sends me a check separately for the streaming as well. So make sure you actually get everything out of it. But no, absolutely yes. And it's not as high as a number as you think. It's the same thing with YouTube. Like there's many people that make a comfortable living from YouTube from just 100,000 subscribers, right? Yeah. It's, I don't know how to, the amount of complaining and how loud these complainers' voices are. Yes, there's a reason to complain, but as far as like the problem versus the ratio of how annoying and loud these complainers are, I've never seen an industry where more people complain more loudly for something so undeserving. Like, I don't know how else to explain it. I am flabbergasted, disappointed, and become borderline cynical and nihilistic whenever I hear people complaining about Spotify. Also, if you look at the numbers of the industry, Spotify could pay artists a little bit more, and they should, and I will always promote that. Like, that is something that they should pay more and take less of a profit. Yeah. To be clear, from the Napster days, the music industry, like, might not be able to do what I do right now if it wasn't for Spotify. Like, how much money the recorded music industry has grown year over year since Napster is almost completely because of the streaming services.
I love that, like, Napster, even if it's not around, still holds a name in why the industry went a certain route.
Dude, it's insane. Yeah. It's insane how much Spotify alone has lifted up the entire recorded music industry. Like, the fact that we can actually make, and there's also different benefits too. Like, bands that used to get paid for album sales would get more money from the album sales, but then would trickle off and wouldn't make much more money after that, right?
Exactly.
So now, if you get one big album, it'll pay for the rest of your life. So it'll be less money now, but more money throughout your career with more lifetime earnings. Because now we're talking about like inflation as well. So like each time you get paid in 10 years, that'll be adjusted to inflation in 10 years from now, which is worth more than streams are now, right? Unless they change significantly, decrease significantly. The amount that they pay per stream, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, the point is yes, it is hard. And yes, these people should pay more. Is it possible? Yes. Is it worth complaining about? No. No. I'm yet to meet people that complain about that at a surface level. Like, there are some people that have really good, valid complaints that have been burned in different industries. Like, for example, like one of my artists had an entire album canceled by the label just because they didn't like it. They weren't getting the streaming numbers that they wanted from the singles, and they didn't like it, so they just dropped the entire album. That sucks, right? Yeah. It makes sense because it wasn't performing well and the numbers weren't showing it, so they just dropped the entire album. Basically not letting him fulfill their contract.
Yeah.
Right? And that sucks, but that makes sense, right? And that's something that I think it's worth complaining about. But for the average person complaining about Spotify streams not paying enough and like going on Facebook and making Instagram stories about it is like absolutely cognitively deficient. That is the replacement phrase for the R word. Cognitively malnutritioned. All right. You need fish, dude. You need to get some healthy omega.
Are you trying to say recession? What?
You need more brain development, my brother or sister. It is possible. A lot of people here are doing it. A lot of people around the world are doing it. Your expectations are way too high. You think that you're better than you are. And again, like, you wouldn't be complaining about that if you were making YouTube videos. So what's the difference between Spotify and making music and making videos? I think the difference is that it's just not so, it's not as easy as YouTube videos to determine this is a good song or not. That's the only difference, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, you can kind of calculate, and based on edits and how you edit, how you film it, like the time and care that you make a video with, like whether a YouTube channel is going to do well or not. Like the care and attention and time and skill is fairly relative, like related, correlated to the outcome of the success of a YouTube channel.
It's true. Not to always, be honest, like, but, you know, when you're seeing an early on YouTuber just by the edits.
Yeah, and it's not nearly correlated the same way in music. And yeah. So I understand why people are frustrated. I'm done ranting. I'm sorry. I'm done ranting. Yeah, it totally is possible. It's not as hard as people think it is. It's also way harder than people think it is, depending on where you're at. It's definitely not worth complaining about. It is worth standing up for and trying to, you know, trying to figure out ways to keep these companies on their toes to get them to pressure them into paying artists more.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's bad now. That doesn't mean it's not possible now. Do not confuse egoic inflation for impossible or restriction. Egoic inflation for restriction. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the right phrase is there. I feel like I didn't articulate that well, but whatever. Let's do a couple more. Cool, Lou?
Let's do it.
Let's do some mixing ones. You should always mix at a low volume.
Oh.
True or false?
Actually, I have an opinion on this. It's both. It's both. It's true and it's false. Trying to balance the vocals, you know, turn your speakers back to like an average listening level, you know? Now, I'm not saying that you should be loud for other things, but sometimes to tell where the bass is in your mix, you do want to turn your speakers up. I think a good example of this, Craig Bauer, I'm butchering his name. Sorry, Craig. But basically, he actually made a post about this weekend that I thought was good because this question is a very common one. Like, how loud are you supposed to be listening? Now, AES standard is between 80 and 85 for a large room. It's about like 70 to 75 for a small room. And a lot of that has to do with like the amount of energy you're putting into the room and how reflections work. But as far as like trying to get the flattest sound to the human ear and stuff like that, it's about in a large room, like a control room, about 80 to 85 dBc, not dBA. dBc is measuring with low end factored in. It's not perfectly flat, but there is a slight tapering in the like the deep, deep sub range. dBA being that it starts to roll off that low end, it is more attuned with like human hearing. So you could see lower numbers in dBA, but we're measuring in dBc on that one. But here's the thing, when you're monitoring low, it's very natural to not hear as much bass. So then if you're mixing your bass at a really low volume, you can make it sound really loud at low volumes, but you have to be careful because once you start turning your speakers up, the bass goes up too, and the balance starts to shift in the way you perceive it. So, you know, check your low end with by pushing the speakers a little bit. I'm not saying lose your hearing or anything, but not everything as easily perceived at a low volume.
I agree. Yeah. So the answer is false. Not everything should be at a low volume.
Yeah.
You should turn it up sometimes. I think on average, though, I think it's healthy. I don't know if it's better, healthy. But it's healthier to have a low volume.
Yeah.
But yeah, you hear differently louder and you hear differently quieter. So, I mean, practically speaking, when I'm like leveling vocals, like turning down or up vocals to fit into the mix a little bit better, I like to turn them down. Like the way that I hear vocals in reference to the instrumental at a lower volume translates better for me. Mm-hmm. And I have better success at doing that than at a loud volume. All right.
You could put on headphones if you want to keep everything low. Headphones have a way of showing you low end, a little exaggerated, but giving you perspective as to where your low end is.
Right. Yeah. True or false, if you need reference tracks, you're not a good mixer.
Bullshit.
Yeah, I would say most of y'all listening need more reference tracks.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm like, listen, as a guy that does both studio and live, reference tracks are an absolute must. If you walk into any venue and think you're going to mix the show just as well as the night before without having some reference tracks to base your understanding of what the room sounds like, you're fucking full of shit, man. Like, I don't know of a single engineer that walks into a new room and doesn't have reference tracks. And that goes for studios as well. There was a time where Keisha Cole and I were doing her album, and we hopped to a different studio like every week or two. So we went to like Record Plant for like a week. We'd go to Malibu for a week. What was it called? Woodshed Recording. We'd go to NRG for a week. But like we'd be hopping around everywhere. Take some reference tracks with you, my guy. Every speaker you're walking into in this scenario is different. Whether you're working on NS10s at Record Plant and then NS10s at Woodshed, NS10s have been so far out of production. The woofers new in box are so hard to come by that just do yourself a favor. Just look up, I don't know if it's on YouTube or if it's on Instagram, but Jesse Ray Mixes did an NS10 comparison, where they scanned every single one he had and all the different eras and how different they are. Every single speaker is the same fucking model and they're all different. If you're walking into different rooms thinking you're hot shit by not pulling out a single reference track and then mixing it there and then calling it done without any reference of any other song existing, I'm sorry, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're not even dumb. You're just ignorant. At that point, like, come on, man, like, have some reference tracks. Don't think you're cool by not having some. Now, if you're very confident in your own room, that's okay. Once again, that's your room. You know it best. You listen to music for thousands of hours in there. I've lived in this house for 2 years, and I still feel like I know it less than I knew in the mix or my old office because of how often I was just locked in one room at that point. But no matter how comfortable I was there, anytime I went to a client's house, to a studio they wanted to go to or anything like that, I needed reference tracks because I don't know that room, you know? So you should be referencing. You should be checking what today's, listen, I know nobody likes talking about top 40 hits because they're like, well, top 40 hits are so variable. You know, it could be country on one record and hip hop the next. Cool. But there are still things that are going on, not necessarily that you have to match the reverbs or anything, but there's things you should probably listen for. Like, how do they tail their reverbs off before the next line? How's the snare verb sounding? How's the kick sounding? Are they big and puffier kicks more lately, or are they just very tight and punchy kicks lately? You know, like, what is it? You know, you can listen for trends and stuff like that, but you should have reference tracks at all times.
Right. Yeah, I agree. We should have reference tracks all the time. I think the biggest mistake for intermediate to beginner mixers is not using reference tracks. Now, and just to put a point on this, we've talked about this a few times. Even some of the most famous or infamous mixers in our industry that, like, for example, Jason Joshua, who, again, is known for saying, fuck your rough mix. I'm here to make hits, not make your rough mix better. When I asked him years ago at Mix with the Masters in person to talk about if he actually ignores the rough mix, and he says, no, I use the rough mix as a proper reference in order to understand what the client wants. So like, yeah, he even, like, even the guy that's known for saying that, you know, F your rough mix, we don't use it, uses reference tracks.
Yeah.
Uses the demo as the reference. I want to be clear too, like, most of the problems with mixing that I hear, like, rarely ever do I hear an intermediate to beginner mixer having like big balancing problems. It's mostly tonal balance, like EQ stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe some balancing stuff too. Not because that they're bad, but because they're so out of scope with what is okay. Like, what is acceptable? Like, they obviously did not, like, if they listen to another song that they like the mix of as a reference while they were mixing this song, their own mix would be way better. Because then they would realize that is way too much low end, because the other reference song does not have that much low end or even close to that much low end. Like, they would realize, oh, this, your mix is really dark and very mid-range forward, where the mix that you're referencing is not at all like that, right?
Yeah.
You would be able to compare and contrast and realize, and because that's what mixing is. Like, you get lost in the sauce, you get blind, you're lost, and you need a way to figure out what's what. And there's no other way to do that than mixing, than reference track. There is no shame in, like, everybody that I know that is a respectable Grammy winning engineer still uses reference track with every single mix. Yeah. Like, every single mix. And so there's no excuse. And I genuinely think referencing is like the number one thing people need to do that, like, is the biggest reason why they're not doing good mixes, is like, because they're, it's very, very obvious when you're not listening to reference tracks, because it's nowhere near what is acceptable for the genre that you are going for. So when I'm giving feedback to someone, I'll tell them the emotions that I'm feeling. I'll be like, this sounds like it was poorly recorded in a garage and it's meant to be an indie record. And if that is not what they intended, that means that that they were not listening to reference tracks. It means they weren't using reference tracks. Because sometimes making it sound like it was recorded in a garage and sounded like it was recorded independently in a garage and it sounds like shit is the vibe, aka half of Billie Eilish's big record a couple years ago, right? Big album a couple years ago. Right, or like Triple X. It's, Sad by Triple X. Like, that's the point. It's not supposed to sound good. But outside of that, like, if you need to have reference tracks, even with stuff that intentionally sounds shitty, you need to have a reference track for. Like, you need to have other intentionally shitty sounding songs. I think that the further along the career you get, like, if you're an advanced mixer, you might need to rely on it less, because you actually now have such a big repertoire or like understanding of what music is supposed to sound like that you can kind of like freeball it, but definitely not during the beginner to intermediate parts of any career or growth. So I'm talking like the first 5 to 10 years, like, you should at the very minimum, like, be listening to reference tracks with every single mix.
You know, there's something I'm really kind of wondering right now. This is more of a question than it is a suggestion or idea to do, because I imagine that there's more that goes into doing this, and you probably shouldn't do it with your client's music. But so a friend of mine and I were talking about how AI can spit out a song in like a minute. And the mix is usually pretty decent. You know, like, I usually don't have any mix critiques. I'm more listening to it creatively and whatever, right? At what point do you think people are going to start just throwing their mix into AI and asking for a critique of the balance and things like that? Being that AI was trained on understanding, like, the levels and, like, traditional balances of things, I don't think that we're too far from that, but I don't like the idea of people submitting other people's music and then in turn training that AI with somebody else's music that they do not own. Right. It was just a thought that comes up, you know, with people asking the question of, like, are reference tracks really that necessary? Yes, they're necessary, but I'm curious to see if eventually we'll get to a point where people are just dropping it into a tool. And we kind of see that now with like tonal balance control too, and Insight from Isotope, where we see certain details, but what we don't see is like the drums could come down a little bit. You know what I mean? So I'm very curious at what point will referencing be an AI tool?
Right. I do think that that'll happen eventually. In fact, you can kind of do it now.
I'm sure you can. I just, once again, I don't feel comfortable with the idea of submitting anything that is not my property.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's end it for this episode now. I'm actually thinking we do a part two because this is going so well.
Yeah, I like this. I like this.
Cool. So let's end it here. Thanks so much for listening to the Mincy Music Podcast. Again, if you want to listen to more exclusive episodes, which is ad-free episodes of our regular episodes alongside the exclusive episodes every single week, go to mincymusicpodcast.com/Patreon or /exclusive. Sign up for the Patreon. Yeah, thanks for everybody that's already signed up. We appreciate you. It's one of the only ways that you can actually help us make money other than listening to the ads, which does almost nothing. I appreciate every single one of y'all. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in part two. Happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy. You already love the Mixing Music Podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today.